Thanks, Katya. Thanks for having me here. I love Steve's reading. My only complaint is it was too short. I wanted to hear some more poems. This is your first time in Montreal, but maybe I can slightly extend his reading by repeating one of his lines. Oh no, it's written on the outside of my thing because it segues perfectly into the first poem that I read. It's nice to get that, you know, that continuity. So he was, one is always tired, slave to circadian rhythms. So I'm going to start with a poem that sort of takes that line and runs with it. It's called Jet Lag, and it's subtitled, or not subtitled, but the italicized line under the title says June Arkhangelsk. So I'm dating it and saying that I wrote it in Archangel, but that's a lie. I've always wanted to go to Archangel, a small city about the size of the city I live in Ontario, Kingston. It's a small city on the White Sea, north of the Arctic Sea, north of the Arctic Circle in European Russia. I got to within 200 or 300 miles of it, to a small city called Petrozavodsk, when I was there in 2007, in June. And I wrote this poem, but because I'd always wanted to go to Archangel, and it just seemed better to place it there. Jet lag. It's night in your bones, though noon. A no-one room drugged with sunlight of a skewed latitude, the fizz and capillaries behind the eyes red rind, unhoused stalling hydraulics of the heart. The insomniac lens of the sun deepens this lag, and dizzies is disinclined to reset this body clock, wonky, jarred as a man who bends to rinse his face clean of a night's journey and straightens to meet himself above the sink. No mirror, his face drywall. Such times a phantom tourist might urge to mind moments that lodge you deep in a life. When you first heard last century's best tenor, Jussi Björling, skewer the sky note in O Helga Natt, and swore no more lies, and of course still lied, but less and less as years went and years went, and that high sea went on compounding in your soul, or for the first time kissed her breasts in the fire alley of a mountain town under the startled brainwaves of the aurora borealis, or hiked the low cliffs of Naxos with the child on your back, her weight bracing your step to soil, so at last you felt present, sheathed in sheer being, she chanting the genesis of all she spied, lending back through the ears narrowed estuary that urgent inventory. These things you summon to seeing, to rudder you in the real, in a no-one room, with night in your bones. What's the poem I did not write in Arkhangelsk, where I'll probably never get there? This is an unrhymed sonnet called The Last Reader, one of a series of poems I wrote in, about 8 or 9 years ago after my mother's death. The Last Reader. The woman whose eyesight is fading tries to read her son's first book. It's long, 300 pages, of which she can take in a page a night at best. When the doctor says she has less than a year, it's not her eyesight he means. As she reads, death gets on with its own determined work, studying, mastering the subtle codes, transcribing her cell by syllable into the dense, vast anthology of the dead. Death never doubts itself, as her son, she knows, must do. Death gets it right each time. She reads till all sense stops rising from the page. This plot no lamp can brighten. A week's worth left to be unveiled. In the still encrypted world, she and her son, the last reader and writer. Next, the poem that follows from that one, a related poem called Herself Revised. It's about one of those liminal moments that I think almost everyone experiences. Herself Revised is the name of the poem. There's a final bedtime when the father reads to his daughter under the half-moon lamp. The wolf-eyed dog sits guard on the snowy quilt at their feet, ears pricked, head upright like a dragon on its hoard, while the daughter's new clock ticks on the dresser. When the father shuts the book, neither feels in the cool sigh cast from its pages a breath of the end. And how can it be that this ritual will not recur? True, this latest story is over, Treasure Island, which held them a dozen nights, but the end has arrived this way often before. Maybe she's tired of the rite, or waking to a sense of herself revised. Maybe he's temporarily bored, or unmoored, reading by duty or rote, turning deeper inside his own concerns. How does the end enter? There's a hinging, like a book's sewn spine in the raw matter of time, that coded text, illegible, and stretched too far, it goes. An innocent break, the father gone one weekend, or the child sleeping at a friend's, followed by a night or two she wants to read alone, or write for a change in her new padlocked journal. She has no idea what has changed. She can't know that the enlargement of her life demands small death after death, and this one, the latest, is far from last. She will not notice this death, being so intent on life, so implied in its stretching cruel work of seconds. Some nights later, suddenly, writing checks or checking email, he might notice and wonder at the change. In a sense, such minor passings pre-enact his own. For a moment, he might lay down his pen, forget the figures, peer over the roof line, and find she was right. Orion, rising, is more blueprint of butterfly or bird than hunter. How does it enter? Through what rift or flaw? Maybe it doesn't enter at all. It was there in every sentence. The end. I think now I'm gonna read a new poem. Don't be alarmed. These are all the drafts of the poem. It's not quite finished. Back to the first handwritten draft. I could see some people thinking, "Oh no, looks like a 20-page poem." It's actually a page and a half, double spaced. How many of you? How can I explain? Two different encounters converged, and so I wrote this poem. I was reading the full life's work of great Romanian Jewish poet Paul Celan last summer. I was reading it in an English translation, two English translations, excellent translations, with the German, also trying to read the German on the facing page, though I struggle and I have a dictionary. And then I started making some translations of the poems I particularly liked, you know, again, struggling, working with a dictionary, and the existing translations. At the same time, I encountered, while surfing, just reading news sites, a story that disappeared from the news cycle within a couple days, maybe 3 or 4 days. Do any of you remember Eden Abergill? Well, I'll just read you the sort of, not epigraph, but the little note under the title. Eden Abergill, former Israeli Defense Forces soldier who posted photos of herself smiling beside bound and blindfolded Palestinian prisoners. She labeled her Facebook album, "The Army, Best Time of My Life." So reading Celan, whose parents were killed in the Holocaust, and then learning about Eden Abergill, just helped generate this poem. It's called "Baffled in Ashdod, Blind in Gaza."